From the Sky News Centre at 5, Tony Blair said no one anticipated the role of Al-Qaeda and neighbouring Iran in the violence following the Iraq invasion. The former Prime Minister has been giving evidence at the Iraq inquiry. He's insisting the war was lawful and justified on the basis of the intelligence they had at the time. Mr. Blair admits it was difficult to secure the country.
People did not believe that you would have Al-Qaeda coming in from outside, and people did not believe that you would end up in a situation where Iran would then try to deliberately to destabilize the country. But that's what they did.
A man on trial for killing a colleague whose limbs were found scattered across two counties has changed his plea to guilty. 38-year-old Stephen Marshall now admits murdering Jeffrey Howe. Relatives say they're appalled a doctor who prescribed potentially hazardous doses of drugs isn't being struck off. That's despite Hampshire GP Dr. Jane Barton being found guilty of serious professional misconduct. She was linked to the deaths of 12 elderly patients. Gillian McKenzie, whose mother Gladys Richards was one of them, says it was obvious Dr. Barton wasn't up to the task.
At 91, you expect your relatives to die. I did not go to the police on emotion. I went because what I had witnessed, I didn't want to happen to anybody else.
Prince Charles and Camilla have visited Wootton Bassett to thank the Wiltshire town for the support it gives. The trip came after crows paid their respects to two British soldiers killed in Afghanistan, Lance Corporal Daniel Cooper and Rifleman Peter Aldridge. Andy Murray will meet Roger Federer in the final of the Australian Open after Federer stormed through his semi-final tie. World number one beat Joe Wilfred Tsonga in straight sets. And Victoria Beckham has landed a presenting job on one of the most high-profile US chat shows. The former Spice Girl has a guest slot on daytime show The View. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Had a funny turn. Perhaps your speech was slurred or you couldn't pick up your cup of tea. You may well have had a mini stroke, also called a TIA. Mini strokes are an early warning sign. Spotting the signs of a mini stroke early and getting treatment can significantly reduce the risk of a full-blown stroke. Like a stroke, a mini stroke happens when the flow of blood to the brain is blocked by a small clot. But unlike a full stroke, with a mini stroke you'll often feel much better within a few hours. Don't ignore them. If you think you may have had a mini stroke in the past, talk to your GP. Strokes happen to people we care about. Act fast. Brought to you by NHS Bristol. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and our guest on the day that war crimes suspect and former Prime Minister of Britain Tony Blair testified at the Chilcot press conference this week is Joe Benefield from Bristol Respect. Our regular old Labour economist and Oxford pundit Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Billy Quain will be along with his credit crunch beating good value for money, what's on this weekend. Also, after six, we hear from some outspoken British Afghanistan war veterans who've witnessed war crimes themselves, and hear from the Governor of the Bank of England whether Obama or Brown has got it right over tightening up bank regulation. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, averaging 2 degrees Celsius in the daytime, a bit colder than the last couple of weeks, and dry with some sunny spells. Next week, averaging 3, still cold, a cloudy week with some outbursts of rain, sleet or snow. Next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of February, averaging 5 degrees Celsius in the daytime, just warming up a little, wet on Saturday, but drier on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and joining us this evening is local Respect Party activist Joe Benefield, with the aspiration, I imagine, to sit on Bristol City Council. Welcome to Drive Time, Helen. Joe?
That was last week.
Joe, so is that right? Are you looking to become a councillor in the city, or what are your political ambitions?
I have stood for election to the City Council. I'm not standing this time around because in my ward there won't be any elections. Yes, so I'm very pleased to be here. I appreciate it very much being invited.
Okay, so tell us about the Respect Party. How long has it been around for and what's its sort of objectives?
I'd say about 5 years. I can't remember exactly. It's 4 or 5 years. And the Respect Party came out of the Stop the War movement. But it's more than just a party for peace, though that's, I think, how a lot of people know us. We want equality. And I think we appeal to a lot of people who feel betrayed by New Labour. We want peace, public services, we want a better environment, we want equality for all.
And so what separates you from the other sort of fringe parties like the Socialist Workers' Party and that kind of thing?
I think we stand consistently to give a political voice to people who want the same things as we do. But we're not just an electoral party. We are campaigning on the ground all the time against racism, for the environment, solidarity with trade unionists in struggle defending their jobs. So I that's what I like about Respect, that we try to give a political voice, but we're there all the time doing things and campaigning for a better world.
The trouble with Respect, though, is it's not with Respect, if I can say that, it's not in power, is it?
No.
What about only George Galloway, the MP?
George Galloway is our MP, and hopefully at the next election, May 6th,
yep.
I think. Thank you, Bob Ainsworth. But hopefully we'll have an MP in Birmingham, that will be Salma Yacoub, Abdul Mir in Bethnal Green and Bow, and hopefully George Galloway, who will be standing in Poplar and Limehouse.
The trouble with the system is it doesn't really allow much for fringe parties like yourself. We were discussing this last week on here, the electoral system. But you really think that you stand a good chance of getting some councillors and possibly more MPs at the general election?
Yes, I think we stand a very good chance, but we'd have to work hard at it. So, I think people want to hear that message, but so many people are very disillusioned about politicians in general.
Well, I think there are millions of people out there that, not listening to this station, but millions of people in general, that really don't feel it's worth voting because there's not all that much difference between the main political parties. So what separates you out as a Respect Party?
Well, I think what we say and what we do. So you don't find many parties who will talk about bringing the troops out of Afghanistan now, who talk openly against privatisation and are prepared to do something about it, that we should be taxing the rich.
Okay.
You know, we should be taxing the rich. And there's plenty of wealth in this country. We're the fourth richest in the world. Why are old people dying of the cold? Why are people on the streets?
OK, so who's one of your favourite past time political figures or even present? Just give us an idea of the sort of politician that you admire.
Tony Benn. I have a great admiration. Well, I mean, a lot of people. You wouldn't find many people who would be critical of Tony Benn, even though, if you remember, he was classed as a monster in the early 80s. And, of course, George Galloway. Salma Yacoub. I think she's a wonderful woman. The way she speaks, the way she can put her ideas over her record on the local council in Birmingham. Do you want any more?
That'll do. We're also joined by Martin Summers. He's our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, a question for you this week. Whatever happened to the balance of payments, and does it matter anymore? I can remember sort of 20, 30 years ago, every day there was an almost obsession on making sure the balance of payments was in our favour. In other words, this is the amount of money that's going into the country and coming out of the country. But why don't people seem to really check that anymore or care about it?
It's because you can carry on running a balance of payments deficit provided you can fund it. In other words, you can borrow sufficient money to cover it. In the past, there was a much more regulated system, and if the balance of payments was a constraint, for example, on government policy, that if you got too much imports and not enough exports, you had to start changing your policy. But because of the kind of fungibility, as they say, in international financial markets now, it's quite possible for countries to run balance of payments deficits provided they can borrow the money to cover what they need to pay. Of course, in the end, of course, we've got huge imbalances now in the world system where everything's being made in China and consumed in the United States, and that's one of the, as it were, those are the two extremes of the system. And this is really, really unbalanced. I mean, the Chinese are totally dependent upon American consumers who've got no money, and then the Chinese use their money to buy up US government debt. And it's a very, very rickety, ramshackle setup.
OK, let's take a look at this week's news stories, then. To start with, really, the big big story of the week and the day is Tony Blair's testimony. So let's have a brief listen to one of the little clips from what Tony Blair was having to say today.
What I said at the in the foreword was that I believed it was beyond doubt. I did believe it. I mean, that was the... And I did believe it, frankly, beyond doubt.
Well, that's him twice saying that he believed beyond doubt. You might wonder what it was that he believed beyond doubt, but that was about the weapons of mass destruction. And I think this is one of the core arguments here, is how can the Prime Minister believe this beyond doubt when most of the country, it seemed, including 2 to 3 million people coming out on the streets, didn't believe a word of it? Joe, let's let you start on this one.
Well, I don't believe him. I don't believe you, Tony Blair. You're a fraud. And I used to love that Stop the War, the banner, Tony Blair, liar. You know, he was a liar. And I don't believe he believed it. He's stupid if he believed it. Ordinary people didn't. And he thought he would con us. The cabinet and most of the government were too spineless to speak up against him. But ordinary people knew what was going on. So splits knew what was going on. And we protested.
So don't you believe that he had the wool pulled over his eyes, possibly by Alistair Campbell or the intelligence people?
No, no. I think he's culpable. I think he... Well, I think they're in league. They used each other to build up a story of deceit that they thought they were going to trick us, dupe us.
Well, obviously, I agree with that. In the vote that was taken just before the run-up to war, which when we had the huge demonstration, which we all went on, we came very close to stopping British participation in the invasion of Iraq. As I know the civil service had already prepared a plan B where America went to war with Iraq and Britain didn't go. And Blair swung it inside the Parliamentary Labour Party by saying that if he didn't get the backing of a majority of Labour MPs, he would resign. And pressure was put particularly on Clare Short to support the government. And because Clare Short supported the government, Blair squeaked home. He'd have had to have gone to war with Tory votes and without the Labour Party, but he said he would resign. I don't think he would have resigned, actually. He was bluffing. And many, many Labour MPs were bamboozled into supporting the war on that basis. But they're all culpable. They should have voted against. Robin Cook did the right thing, resigned from the government and said, this is wrong, we're not going to vote for it. And that's what Labour MPs should have done. And any Labour MP that didn't do that, they've got a really big mountain to climb with public credibility out there now.
Yes, real credit. Real credit to those like Robin Cook, who, you know, would resigned, and that shows. I think they show the other politicians up when they do the honourable thing. And of course, George Galloway was one of those who spoke out against it. You know, not only resigned, I mean, he was kicked out of the Labour Party, but he was prepared to speak out. And all credit. And I'm very proud of ordinary people. Of the Bristol Stop the War movement, we sent up 64 coaches, wasn't it, Martin?
66, I think.
66 coaches. And that was the sort of mood for against war and for peace. And it is satisfying now to see them all creeping around like Robin Cook saying, oh, I was concerned about it. Of course, then that testimony is contradicted by the legal advisers who say they were warned and he was blocking the evidence that they and the judgment that they wanted to give and make public. But there's thousands of lives lost. You can't imagine the suffering. You know, he can sit there in his nice suit and talk like an actor and play games, verbal games. There's been dreadful suffering, death, destruction for his belief. So shame on you, Tony Blair. Shame on you. We'll never forget what you've done.
One of the interesting things also, which was being discussed today, was this whole thing of the legal case. Was there a legal case for war? It does seem to me pretty clear that Lord Goldsmith was advising against that until he took a trip to the United States and he came back with a completely the opposite point of view. Anyway, another one of the main points is that Tony Blair today has been constantly talking about the successful mission in Iraq, successful mission in Iraq. What are both of your thoughts on that particular topic? Joe, you first.
I don't know what he means by success. I don't know how he gauges success. there was a report the other day about the suffering that is now caused for generations of children because of the weapons that have been dropped, you know, the pollution, the contamination. It's not a success in Iraq. It was one of the most advanced countries, women being educated, the infrastructures, because of sanctions before the invasion. But it's a broken society. It's riven with sectarianism. They talk about Al-Qaeda presence there. Well, it wasn't there before they invaded it. They destroyed a country.
Well, obviously, totally agree with that. I mean, I wish the people of Iraq well. They deserve something. Something better than what they've been forced to put up with. I don't see. I mean, why most Commonwealth countries opposed Britain's intervention, and they did. Apart from Australia, all Commonwealth countries were opposed to our intervention in Iraq. That's what Mandela said at the time. Is you can't have one rule for you and one rule for everybody else. We're trying to establish a rule of law here that you can't just invade other people's countries because you don't like them. That was set in stone in 1948 in the United Nations Charter, and it's all very well to say, oh well, it's set in stone, except when it's not set in stone. What for example, if China decided to invade a province of India, and they could say, oh well, you know, we're allowed to invade things as well. And once you've created the possibility that people say, well, we don't have to pay attention to that rule, well, then everybody doesn't have to pay attention to that rule. And they can't see what the consequences will that be further down the line. We might come to some other international crisis further down the line where people will take that precedent and say, oh, well, you did it, we're going to do it.
Is it that they can't see, or is it they don't care?
It's that they don't care. There is the rule of law, as practiced by the Western states, is the rule of law only applies when they want it to apply, and when it doesn't want to apply, it doesn't apply. Like the United States are not signatories to the International Criminal Court. And you know why that is? Because quite straightforwardly, some of these people who've been ordering torture would have to go there and be sent down. So they're not going to do that, so they've not signed up for it. Of course, Slobodan Milosevic has got to go, because he's a bad guy. But of course, our people, they're not answerable. And that's the problem, is that the people running US policy are, in fact, criminals. Robert Gates, who is the current defense secretary, he was the head of the CIA in the 1980s when the Mujahideen were armed and trained in Afghanistan, funded through heroin. He was involved in the Iran-Contra affair. He was given a pardon. He should be in prison. He's not in prison. He's in power. And that's the problem. We've got a criminal class in charge of things, and that's not political rhetoric. It's beyond party politics. These are criminal acts. Simple as that.
Okay, on to the next story. David Kelly, this was one from last weekend. David Kelly, the post-mortem apparently now is to be kept secret. This is the government scientist who died just before the beginning of the invasion of Iraq. Now, it's going to be kept secret for 70 years. The doctors are accusing Lord Hutton, though, of concealing vital information. Joe, what are your thoughts about the contents of the post-mortem of David Kelly?
It just shows the sort of society that we live in, and who controlled, you know, free democratic society. We have got rights, we fought for them, and we've got to fight to keep them. But there's also this other secret world that goes on. Why 70 years? You know, that it was supposed to be a suicide. There's obviously a lot of evidence to suggest he isn't. The people who are responsible for that situation don't want the truth to come out. If you've nothing to hide, why is it being kept secret? 30 years is bad enough, and it's great when those documents come out, and it's after the event. So they think 30 years after the event, when the truth comes out, it's too late to change anything. You know, it's all in the past. 70 years, it makes you think there must really be something there that they've got to hide if they're waiting for 70 years to bring it out. And Alistair Campbell said it made him feel physically sick when he heard that he heard the news that David Kelly had committed suicide. It gives you a little inkling, a little eye, you know, just a little peep of what really goes on in the society.
Yeah, well, obviously, I totally agree with that. I mean, Norman Baker, the Liberal MP, has been doing a good job of trying to get to the bottom of this. And all of these doctors, like Chris Burns-Fox up at Frenchie, I mean, he says that there's no medical way in which this guy can have committed suicide by slashing his wrists in the way they've suggested. He's supposed to have cut his wrist from... I'm trying to show you here, because we're on radio.
He's crossing his arms over in front of him, almost twisting them around.
The paramedics that found the body said the body had been moved. I mean, it's clear, to my mind, that he was murdered. And what's really scary, I mean, how do you think Nazi Germany started? People like this were murdered, in full sight, nothing was done, and you say, oh, it's only one person murdered in clear sight like that by the state, presumably by a state, if not the state, and we've all averted our eyes. Now, that is the road to tyranny. When things like that happen, and nobody's held to account, and somebody is murdered, and we'll just close our eyes and close our ears, then we are on the road to tyranny. And that's exactly how Nazi Germany came about. People closed their eyes, walked by on the other side of the road, because it was only one individual, and then it was 10 individuals, and then it was 300 individuals, and off we went. And this is the line in the sand. It should be properly investigated. It's not being investigated. And it does reflect back on the Iraq War stuff, doesn't it? I mean, they knew what they were. I don't believe Tony Blair believed there were weapons of mass destruction inside Iraq. He was getting all the information he was getting. There wasn't any. So there's a whole farrago of lies and deceit here, and murder. It's a nasty, nasty mess, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's one interesting line in this article from the Mail on Sunday. I think it's the Mail on Sunday, maybe the Saturday Daily Mail last weekend. That is, last night the Ministry of Justice was unable to explain the legal basis for Lord Hutton's order. Because, of course...
there isn't one.
Okay, Joe, your final thoughts on the whole Kelly fiasco? Well, it's obviously not a fiasco for his friends and family. It must be very, very troubling.
Yeah, and it was shocking. You know, and when people heard about the... I know Tony Blair was on a plane. I know he's travelling somewhere surrounded by journalists. He looked shocked because people knew what the background was and he knew the truth about the weapons of mass destruction. Could I just mention something else? Following on from what Martin was saying about the rise of the Nazis, I'm also... I'm Secretary of the Bristol Defend the Asylum Seekers campaign and very involved in the mistreatment of asylum seekers. And there is something, you know, when Martin says these things happen and there might be just one case, two cases, and if something isn't done or you don't speak out, it becomes just acceptable. In Bristol, in the UK, there are children who were dragged out of their beds at 6 o'clock in the morning by uniformed policemen and uniformed officers, and they're taken and put in detention. This is happening here, and it's happened in Bristol. On Monday, we will be having a time for questions where children who've suffered this experience will be giving their testimony, because sometimes that eyewitness account is so moving. And it will be at the City Academy, Russell Town Avenue. It will be 10:30 in the morning, and it is a must if you can make it. There were 400 there last time.
I mean, yeah, I think just thinking of the sort of questions people will be thinking about that, though, are along these lines, is that don't you think there are some legitimate complaints about immigration that... you seem to be almost sort of talking about this as an immigration issue. A lot of people are concerned that too much is done to help people stay in the country.
Yeah, I think that's because it's based on ignorance. I think it's based on policies. I think it's the government thinking that we all think like the Daily Mail and that we, you know, they have to respond to their views. And there's a lot of distortions about asylum seekers and refugees and immigrants. And if people heard the truth, and sometimes they hear the truth when they get to know someone personally, their ideas change, you know, that they can't work, they have to survive on £35 a week. It takes 9 years sometimes for the case to be heard properly. If we had a fair system, it would be different. We have not got a fair system. And I don't think there's any excuse for treating children like that. You just have to put yourself in that position, don't you? And like Martin said, this is what happened in the 30s. And because people did speak up, but it was a big penalty they faced, didn't they? They'd be taken to the concentration camps. We're not in that stage now. But we have to speak up now. Where there's injustice, you know, people need to speak up, and they do speak up.
So are you in favour of economic migrants too?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, considering my family came from Ireland after the famine, when the famine was on, and my mother was Burmese, so I am. I think it's what I want to live in, a multicultural world.
Okay, now back to Iraq. Final story on Iraq is this week is the execution of Chemical Ali, and the also this is the guy who was allegedly responsible for the bombing or in Halabja with chemical weapons and various other misdemeanors, and the suicide bombers targeted the high profile hotels in Baghdad on the same day that Chemical Ali was executed. Martin, do you want to start on this one? Do you think this is a good thing? This guy's finally been sorted out, apparently, by the new administration.
What's interesting about this is I mentioned earlier the International Criminal Court, and the obvious place to send somebody like this would be to the International Criminal Court. Now, he hasn't been sent to the International Criminal Court, because if he had been sent to the International Criminal Court, his defence would have been, call George Bush Sr., call Donald Rumsfeld, you sold me all of the stuff for my chemical weapons, didn't you? And that's why he's been tried in a kangaroo court in Iraq and executed out of hand. Because, of course, his defence would be that you're guilty as well. That doesn't mean that he's not guilty. He is. But then so are Bush and Rumsfeld.
Yes, I agree with you, Martin. It's so good to have things like that aired, isn't it, to be made public. And who... You know, where did the helicopters come from? Of course he's a nasty piece of work, and of course he should be held responsible, but how he should be held responsible, the evidence that comes out, and exactly, Martin, spot on. The way it was done is because they didn't want international publicity for it. They were part of that crime. They were part of that crime. They backed Saddam Hussein. They armed him. They provided them with the gas. Everything's different now, and they think that we've forgotten, but we haven't.
So are you saying you think that maybe the reason he's been executed is because he knows too much about relationships?
Effectively, yes. I mean, I personally don't think you should execute war criminals, because you can always find out more about what they've done and get other people. Yeah, so you put them in behind bars.
You're talking about Rudolf Hess and this
whatever,
kind of...
and then you carry on. You go back to them and say, "Hang on a minute, we've got some more information here, and we've got some other people we want to catch, and we need your evidence." So once you've executed people, then of course that's the end of that, isn't it? And that's why I'm opposed to capital punishment in principle. Although I actually think that, you know, sometimes examples might have to be made, but in general, political crimes shouldn't be punished with execution, because there's always more that you can find out if you dig a bit deeper.
Okay, our next story. Unequal Britain. The richest 10% are now 100 times better off than the poorest. And this is quite amazing to see Harriet Harman yesterday delivering this report after she'd commissioned it herself. I thought it was quite as changed to see the government bringing forth a report which is actually quite critical of them. Joe, do you want to start on this?
Yes, I think it was really interesting listening to Harriet Harman saying how, you know, they were striving, the Labour government was striving to change this situation. I thought, Harriet, I wanted to shout at the radio, we've had three terms of a Labour government. You've been in since 97. Why haven't you done something about it? And, you know, my partner jokes, oh, wait, when there's a problem, wait till Labour gets in, then we'll sort it all out. This is shameful. It's absolutely shameful. The gap has increased. I can't remember the name of the book. Was it called Plum?
Spirit level,
that's it.
I can't remember the name of it.
No, I went to buy it, but it cost too much, and I'm waiting for it to come out in paperback.
Professor John Hills.
Where is it? Right. And the, you know, the physical effects it has on people being poor, but to live in a society where there is that gap between the rich and the poor, it affects people on a psychological level as well. You are made to feel inferior. It increases your mental instability, which we all know anyway. But the idea that the rich haven't been taxed, that the bankers are allowed to have bonuses, all these things that we supposedly can't afford, the fourth richest country in the world, that's not good enough. There should have been three terms of a Labour government. There should have been a narrowing of the gap, not the widening of it.
Yeah, well, as a Labour Party member, I find it difficult to disagree with that. I just give a plug for the book, because it's been very influential, and I saw the guy do a presentation, actually, at a Compass meeting in London. This is Professor John Hills, who's written this book. What's interesting about the studies is that the more equal your society is, the happier and healthier people are. And it doesn't seem to matter whether you're rich or poor. Poor societies which are equal are happier and healthier than rich societies which are unequal. And the most successful societies are places like Iceland used to be before they crashed their economy, where you've got basically a a very narrow income differential in those kind of Nordic countries. And that's, of course, we're a North European country. We should be managed like that. Why haven't we been? And, of course, the reason is that New Labour bought into the neoliberal economic ideology. And they've not been prepared to have anything like an industrial policy, for example.
But isn't it
they've not been prepared to do all of the traditional things that Labour governments used to do. They've forsworn them. And, of course, the result is what we see, which is, of course, growing inequality. That's what the market produces, unless you intervene to rejig it. And in case people think, but at least we're more efficient, it's just not true. More equal societies are more efficient. Mm. The highest level of investment per worker and the ownership of personal computers, productivity per worker, is in those Nordic countries which have strong government intervention.
But don't you think it's just that poor societies or societies with large numbers of poor people and a big division, actually the whole motivation caused by money then is much, much more powerful in those societies, because those people are coming from poverty. If you've got a sort of everybody's roughly in the middle somewhere, then there aren't really any incentives, are there?
That's not true. We've had Conservatives on this programme arguing exactly this kind of line. As I just pointed out, you can keep incentives. I mean, bosses used to earn 15 or 16 times what the shop floor earned. It's now something like 200 or 300 times. It's just way, way out of control. And of course, what happens then is that the wealthy classes, they can't spend all that money, so what do they do with it? They speculate, and they create bubbles, which then crashes the economy. If they haven't got the money, nobody needs... we talk about having a minimum income. Perhaps we ought to talk about having a maximum income. How much do you... What's the cut-off point? Presumably, you know, and in actual fact, the wealthy classes would go out to work for a lot less than they're paid. And when Bristol City Council is employing dustbin collectors or whatever, they don't try and overpay them, they try and pay them the market rate. And we should be doing exactly the same with the super wealthy. We shouldn't be overpaying them. We should be trying to pay them the market rate, and the market rate's a lot lower than they're actually being paid. They'd still do what they do for a lot less than they're being paid now.
Yeah, because you only get what you pay for, don't you? And you think about the bankers, well, we've got to pay them lots of money and give them billions in bonuses. Why?
Isn't it just because they are the ones that control the bank accounts?
They've got this delusion that they're somehow a productive... In actual fact, the City of London, if you want to look at it in one way, is like a great big worked-out South Wales coal mine. And in actual fact, what we did with South Wales coal mines when the coal was worked out, we closed them down and sacked everybody. Yeah. And maybe that's what we've got to do with the City of London. Just close the shop and sack everybody.
Well, we were reminded the other day about Peter Mandelson saying he was intensely relaxed about the filthy rich. This is Peter Mandelson, who was twice sacked for fraud and misconduct and is now an unelected member of the government. That's his sort of philosophy. And you think about...
And if he can come back, we can come back.
Ah. And I'm a... What was it? I'm a fighter, not a quitter. But what a poor opinion of ordinary people. How does the blood transfusion system work? It works on the basis of people genuinely wanting to give something to their community. They don't get paid for it. They spend their time giving their blood, and it's free. And I heard a proposal about maybe paying people to donate blood, and you think that would be the end of the blood transfusion service. If you bring in a profit motive, removed one wonderful aspect of our society.
It's just one less community-spirited thing around, isn't it?
Well, I mean, if you remember in the 80s, the Tories bought in blood plasma from the United States because it was cheaper than, so they thought, than getting it, the NHS doing it in-house. And, of course, all this blood plasma was bought from junkies and others on the streets of Texas, and it's all contaminated with HIV. And in fact, it's cost us millions. And of course, people have lost their lives as a result of that.
Anyway, it's just about 25 to 6 now, and time to take a break from our news review to hear our guest Joe Benefield's choice of music. music. So, Joe, what is this song and why did you choose it? It's track four we'll be listening to, but why Beethoven?
I really love Beethoven. I came very late to classical music. You know, I used to be one of those who laughed at the funny people looking like penguins and the mad conductor in the front. I only came to it very late in life. And I like Mozart and Bach, and I love Beethoven because it has an emotional effect on me. But quartets, I think, are like conversations. They're like people communicating, human relationships. And the piece that's being played, you're hearing it in isolation, but the whole musical piece, it's Grand Fugue and Quatuor de number 13, is you get friction and conflict and stress, and you think, oh, it's unbearable, you can't listen to this anymore, it's so discordant. And then you get a crescendo, and then it's this peaceful, harmonious, and it is very much like human life, I think. So you'll hear a bit of it, but I don't know whether it'll give you an idea really of what the whole piece is about, but I love it.
Tedesca, I hope I pronounced that right. It's a quartet, the quartet, in B-flat major. That's the chosen by today's guest on BCFM's Friday Drive Time, Joe Benefield from Bristol Respect. Now back to our review of the week's news. And let's start with, we don't often do football on here, but we had a terrible result last weekend. We can't mention, this is stories from Bristol247.com. And a catalogue of defensive errors combined with an on-fire Cardiff City condemned Bristol City to a humiliating 6-0 defeat at Ashton Gate last weekend. Joe, do you think this is indicative of something that's going on at Bristol and Cardiff here, or is this just a freak result?
Oh, I think it's terrible. I feel really sorry for all those Bristol City supporters. One of them is my son-in-law. I refrained from giving him a text about it and not mentioning it because my partner's a supporter of Bristol Rovers. But I think it's ridiculous, actually, this rivalry. I know it exists and there's not much you can do about it. And when it comes to it, you know the posties? The two posties that were sacked from the Seven Beach. They were representatives. They were sat from the Seven Beach warehouse. And one of the reasons was that they turned up in a city strip on the picket line in a Rovers, and they were united. So that was great. But
Martin, what about you?
I'm bored by football.
I think this relates to what we've discussed on previous weeks, which is the city getting a new ground in the south of the city.
Could this be karma, do you think? Well, I mean, obviously,
it seems to be going ahead, but the doubts are that they will, because they're not actually as good as they need to be to attract the crowds that they're going to need to attract to make the new stadium viable. And, you know, there's also the questions about parking and so on with the new stadium. And people walk to Ashton Gate at the moment, and, you know, in many ways they can drink. There's no kind of, you know, once you've got it out of the city and everybody's got to drive there, it'll have a rather different atmosphere. But, I mean, it's sorry for them, but, I mean, you know, these things happen.
Do you think maybe the management at Bristol City have just taken their eye off the ball here and off the getting the team right? They're spending too much time concentrating on their
development. In my view, it's a game of two halves, Tony. It's a game of two halves, and it's never over till it's over.
A freak result, then?
Well, this is the kind of thing that sometimes happens, isn't it? At least it wasn't 15-0, you know.
Right, OK, we're going on to look at some local stories now. The future of Portishead Pool has been secured. Well, this is a privately owned pool, so therefore it is secure. And many of the pools, of course, in Bristol now have been closed down and privatised and various things. So a bit of good news at last. Joe, can you say a comment on this one?
I'm really glad that the Portishead Pool has been saved. I don't think it would have been saved if ordinary people hadn't campaigned about it. But I remember taking my kids in the summer, especially on a Sunday afternoon, up to the open air pool in Clifton. It was publicly owned. It was a fantastic facility that lots of people enjoyed. Then there were cuts in the service because people used to go there in the daytime. People from work used to walk up there and use it. There were cuts in staff, so it was closed at dinner time, which is when a lot of people tended to use it. And it was cut back and cut back, closed down. It was going to be sold off for private flats. Local people campaigned, stopped that happening. It's been saved. Why is it private? Why didn't it remain a public service, a public amenity for us all to be able to use? I think it's very expensive now, but these are the sort of things that you know, we should all have.
But the Portishead Pool Community Trust, which took over management of this place in March 2009, it charges very little. So
no, that's good. Yeah. That is good. But maybe that's because the community campaigned to get it. But you know, the Clifton Pool, I don't know how much it costs, but I've been told it's expensive.
Martin, what about you? Are you someone that goes keeping your fitness up regularly every week down to the swimming pool?
I like going walking in the country rather than swimming, to be honest with you. I mean, it's good that the facility has been saved. What I find is very strange about the Portishead Pool Community Trust. Did this pool used to belong to the council?
It was a council pool,
but it's been put into the social economy as a.
I think basically, what's happening with
profit
in here
company.
Is a similar thing that's happening in the city in Bristol, which is that the council is saying, and the people running it are saying, "Oh, well, these places are no longer viable." And they're only viable if we sell them off and they're privatised or whatever. And there are less and less, it seems to me, I mean, over the last 8 years or so, it's been several, I'm not sure how many are left now in Bristol, but this seems at least to be one solution, with a community trust taking it over. Another local story, we're happy, apparently, with the service provided by North Somerset Council. This is a story in the Bristol Evening Post earlier this week, which is a totally uncritical reporting of Somerset Council press release, which I found a little bit disturbing, in that North Somerset Council are telling everybody that everyone's happy with their service in a survey that they have conducted themselves. I don't know what your thoughts are on this. Did we give this any credibility at all?
Well, I mean, you've got to give it the credibility that it naturally has. I mean, councils obviously try and work out whether people are happy or are satisfied with what they're providing or what they're not providing.
Personally very sceptical, because a lot of the other stories around this week to do with North Somerset Council and even Somerset Police, because of course there's been a big privatisation of the civilian support services at Avon and Somerset Police and in North Somerset Council to IBM with this company called Southwest One, and we have another story here about the Avon and Somerset computers which aren't working, and the next one is to do with North Somerset Council spending £50,000 on recruiting people from Australia. So, I mean, it does seem that this is almost being run as a kind of, without a lot of thought as to where the money's being spent in North Somerset Council.
Well, North Somerset Council, as you know, is controlled by the Conservatives, and they've basically contracted out most of their services.
But when they're contracting out things so fundamental as personnel and all sorts of civilian support services for the police, do you think that this is vulnerable?
Well, don't forget that the police is not the same thing as North Somerset Council. I mean,
it's a lot of crossover.
Yes, there's a lot of crossover. They're two different institutions, so you can't just elide them together like that. The problem with North Somerset Council, as far as I can see, or any contracting out, is you lose accountability. It's like being a housing association tenant as opposed to being a council tenant. It becomes opaque. Who's responsible? You don't know who to complain to. And you know, there's a whole another layer of people you've got to get through before you can get anything sorted out. So,
Southwest Tory MP Ian Liddell Granger has talked here about the collapse of Avon and Somerset Police's computer system. Amazingly, I think it's called the SAP. It seems to be sapping all the energy of the police as they try to use it.
Do you remember we had Councillor Ron Stone on here a few weeks ago, and he was talking about the fire because he sits on the fire authority.
Yeah.
And computerisation has been absolutely bungled in this country in all public departments. When you think back to the asylum seekers department, the hospitals, schools, all of these private computer whizzes have ended up costing billions.
Yeah,
and it's just scandalous that public money has been chucked down the toilet in all these rubbish computer programs.
Okay, Joe, over to you. Okay. This is a sort of form of privatisation of our local authorities, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's the unaccountability of it, isn't it? When you hear, you know, there was the NHS computer in, was it Portsmouth? Millions of pounds, and it had been bungled. And you think, well, how was it ever drawn up in the first place? Who is accountable for it? You don't seem to have that accountability, which is important. And because there's a profit motive in it as well, isn't there? I mean, I heard it, I was horrified to read that they're privatising fostering out agencies because, you know, they call it efficiency. I just think it's another way for people to make money, and the service from privatisation always deteriorates for the people who work in the industry or the service and for us, the users of it. As far as consultation exercises go, well, we've seen some of those, and I think the answer has been decided before the consultation, and again, the private companies, and they work to get the answer they want. You know, Southmead Hospital was one of them, Broadmead Development was another one. I don't think consultations have much credibility.
Okay.
Especially if they're privatised.
Okay, we're joined by Marina Morris, and Marina's got a report this week for us all on the first stage of the Ukrainian elections.
Oh yes, hello. On Sunday, the 7th of January, Ukraine held the first stage of the fifth Ukrainian presidential election since independence was internationally recognized on the 26th of December 1991. It is the first presidential election since the Orange Revolution 5 years ago. 67% of voters is in 46 million population cast a vote. This compares with 62% turnout at the last UK general election. Officials from the Organization for Security and Cooperation said the election was a high quality and they met Ukraine's democratic communities commitments. The leader of the opposition and former Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych, 59, who was declared president under the country's Orange Revolution of 2004, received 35% of vote cast. The Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, 49, who helped to lead the pro-Western revolution against Yanukovych's disputed 2004 claim of victory and is most popular in the European-leaning west of the country, received 25% of the vote cast. Ukraine President Viktor Yushchenko, the one-time hero of the Orange Revolution, has been eliminated from the country's presidential election with around 6% of the vote. And other 13 candidates were also eliminated. two candidates, Yanukovych and Tymoshenko, will face each other in round two of the presidential election on February the 7th. Now, they are both are trying to win the support of eliminated candidates. Such politician as Sergei Tegibko received 13% of votes and Arseniy Yatsenyuk 4%. The president has the power to appoint a number of key governmental posts, the ministers of defense, foreign affairs, and the head of the state secret service. And it might be not to be surprising if these posts are awarded to defeat candidates who publicly support the victor. Despite lagging behind by 10% of the votes, analysts said that Tymoshenko is in a strong position to leapfrog Yanukovych and seems sent to be the country's first female president. Other commentators point out that Yanukovych has benefited most from the general feeling of disillusionment and has strong support from elderly voters whose pensions have lost much of their value. The election comes as Ukraine is in a financial crisis that saw the economy shrunk by 15% last year. The country is due to repay £12.5 billion of foreign, mainly corporate, debt this year, and the national currency, the hryvnia, is down 50% since the crisis began. 5 years ago, Ukraine's Orange Revolution was hailed as a new start for a country that had begun to look west towards the European Union and NATO. Whether Yanukovych or Tymoshenko wins, the goal of NATO membership is almost certain to be abandoned. Officials close to the Kremlin have said the NATO membership for Ukraine and Georgia was seen as a threat to Russia. In Ukraine, the word of the day on Russia are pragmatism and balance. Both Yanukovych and Tymoshenko will find a balance of interest between Russia and Ukraine's integration this Europe, especially in economic matters. Leading the first stage of presidential election, Yanukovych has retained his popularity in the Russian-speaking East and the South. Viktor Yanukovych said he would be keeping the country out of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, a Moscow-led defense grouping. He would push to join the economic union being formed by Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus. Russia has lately favored economic integration and pushed for the ruble to become a regional reserve currency as a means of spreading its influence. Yanukovych is understood to have angered Moscow by supporting Ukraine's attempt to join to European Union. But Tymoshenko has become the unexpected hero of the Kremlin after tempering the anti-Russian stance that was a hallmark of her 2004 campaign and early premiership. While remaining pro-European, she has built a pragmatic alliance with Vladimir Putin, the Russian Prime Minister. The two very publicly ended the drawn-out Gaza dispute between the two countries last winter and were credited with avoiding a repeat this year. European leaders will be aware that an election's outcome could affect the continental vital energy supplies. Europe gets a quarter of its gas from Russia, and most of that arrives through an extensive network of pipelines running through Ukraine. Both candidates have strong interest in the gas trade. Yanukovych's power based in the East depends on Russian gas to fuel its predominantly heavy industries. Tymoshenko made her money in his gas trade in the 1990s and has been nicknamed the Gas Princess. Tymoshenko now calls the Orange Revolution a revolution of lost opportunities. This hindsight, freedom of speech, is one of the few benefits of the Orange Revolution, most people can agree. Despite the general disillusionment of the populace, it is unclear whether the 7th of February will see an orange sunset or an orange sunrise in Ukraine.
So which way do you think they're going to vote? I know if I'm allowed to ask you.
I think Ukrainian people will take vote for the best candidate.
Okay, that's a very diplomatic answer. Joe, I mean, this is the biggest country in Europe, and I think it's interesting to try and figure out which way they're going to go, if they're going to go to the east or the west, or they're going to play the one against the other. Do you think the people are going to, at the end of the day in Ukraine, are going to get a say here?
No. From your report, Marina, you get the impression that the people, the ordinary people, the masses, are the spectators. You know, the great powers for control, make alliances, manoeuvres, and the ordinary people are sort of passive recipients of whatever happens to these political manoeuvrings. I was always wary. I know that people in Ukraine did want change, but I was very wary about American USA involvement in the Orange Revolution, just as I know that the Americans have been very involved in the opposition in Iran. And we understand exactly why people want freedom, and like you said, freedom of speech, but at a time of crisis as well. I don't think that the ordinary people are players in it. I don't think they have benefited from it. And you can tell by the, you know, the disillusionment with the change that did take place, that they're hankering for, some of them are hankering for a return to what they had, even though I don't think that was socialist or anywhere near socialism.
So in the second stage, Martin, which side is your 10 shillings on?
Well, obviously, it's very hard from this distance to make an assessment, but I mean, I'm surprised that Yanukovych has done as well as he has, because he was very much the guy who was out during the Orange Revolution. And I think it shows that the mood in Ukraine has obviously shifted quite dramatically in a pro-Russian direction, if you like. The things that strike me is, A, the economic crisis in Ukraine. They're suffering really badly there because they're caught up in this global economic crisis, and they've got particular problems of their own. But I'd just like to say it's also clear that it's been a very clean election. Everybody's been very clear that there was no cheating. Yanukovych has got the most votes in the first round, and I think whoever wins, as long as there's a sense of common purpose in Ukraine and everybody accepts the democratic results, then I can't see that will be bad for the country. I think there's there's this kind of sobering mood taken over, hasn't there? And whoever wins, I think the Ukrainians to be congratulated on having a very successful, clean election.
Okay, next story. We've got to see if we can squeeze two in before the 6 o'clock news. Trade unionist Mick Dooley claims Balfour Beatty used a secret blacklist to deny him work as a bricklayer. A trade unionist is suing a major construction firm for allegedly blacklisting him in what promises to be the first of a series of lawsuits brought by workers. Mick Dooley, 50, has accused Balfour Beatty of using a secret blacklist to deny him work as a bricklayer on a building site. He's claiming £35,000 in damages. Last year, the Information Commissioner Richard Christopher Graham named Balfour Beatty amongst 14 firms that unlawfully brought personal details of workers from a database of more than 3,200. The database apparently was used by firms to vet workers who might cause trouble and contain warnings such as "Do not touch, Communist Party," and "Ex-shop steward, definite problems, do not touch." Joe, I know you've got a little bit of knowledge of this case. Can you just give us a brief outline of what you think of it?
Well, Jerry Hicks is a Respect member. He's the convener of Bristol Respect. If you remember, he was the convener who was sacked by Rolls-Royce, and an 8-week strike followed that. He was up at the tribunal in London for 3 days that it was being heard, and he's been very involved in this blacklisting campaign. And these troublemakers are people who are very brave, who are very determined, who against all the odds will demand safety, because that is the big thing on a building site, that they want safe working conditions and decent pay, union agreements and job security. And because these people have been prepared to stand up for that, they were blacklisted, and I've seen some of the files of, it's just amazing, I think, that it all came to light. I think it was a police prosecution. It's obviously people campaigning that has made them.
All right, so these documents have come out through disclosure in a court case,
yeah.
And now they've been picked up on. And,
yes.
I mean, of course, if there's a secret database about you, you've no way of verifying whether any of that information is correct, Martin.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is supposedly data protection.
Well, that's what this legislation is here that's being used.
Mm. I mean, we've known for years that companies, big companies like Balfour Beatty, have been involved in blacklisting people. It's completely unacceptable in a democratic society, and that's why they're being ferreted out. And, you know, they need to be ferreted out. You know, people should be able to speak up for what they believe in their workplace without fear of intimidation by their employer.
OK, finally, we just have time. A doctor at the centre of the MMR row is facing being struck off after General Medical Council rules his autism research was misleading. Now, I just wonder what both of you's thoughts are about the whole MMR scandal. Is it something that you're happy to... would you be happy to... have your children have the MMR vaccine, Jo?
I would. I think the scepticism about the MMR, because there were three separate vaccines, weren't they? And the government was telling people it was safe. The scepticism about it said a lot about the way people viewed the government and how they trusted the government on all sorts of issues. That when they, there was concern expressed about it, and the government said, no, this is... fine. I would like to say I do feel very strongly about this, because I think you have to be responsible now, and people who haven't had their children vaccinated, they really should do that, because there are children who can't be vaccinated, children with transplants, children with cystic fibrosis, having treatment for cancer, they can't be vaccinated, and they are a severe risk.
Sorry, Joe, we got the news coming.